everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, edition 264. My name is Patrick Gray. On this week's show, I'll be playing an excerpt from a panel discussion that took place at KiwiCon last weekend. The session was called Three Guys with Ponytails Talk Security, and those three guys are PGP Corporation co-founder John Callis, Encipher co-founder Nico Van Someren, and the University of Auckland's Peter Gutman. The topics include quantum computing and Peter's oddly overkill print server. That's coming up in a bit. This week's show is brought to you by Adobe, and Adobe's head of product security and privacy, Brad Arkin, joins the show in this week's sponsor segment to talk about what he's calling Phantom O-Day. But before we get into all of that, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with our good buddy, Adam Boileau. And Adam, in our first bit of news this week, sacre bleu! The French are claiming that they got ponzerized by the United States government using flame as an internet weapon.
Yeah, this is an interesting story, isn't it? They're claiming that Sarkozy, the French president's office, was owned by the U.S. government. Apparently, there was some initial phishing done via Facebook for people who were sort of indirectly involved, and they worked onwards from there and owned a bunch of stuff and stole presumably a bunch of important data. And of course, accusing the Americans as in public is, going to go a long way towards improving relations, I'm sure. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this unfolds. It's interesting that they assert that it was the flame malware, because there was a tweet that came out from the CrowdStrike guys yesterday, basically saying, like, anyone who thinks flame is from the US hasn't done their attribution right. And of course, CrowdStrike have a bunch of smart people working for them. So it's going to be interesting to see how that dovetails with this story, because it may well turn out that it's actually, somebody other than the Americans when it comes out in the wash. But yes, this is, this kind of escalation of the use of cyber, intergovernmental things. Yeah, drink. Hang on a sec. Oh, my drink's empty, doll. thankfully, my drink is empty, because this kind of escalation is, we're only obviously going to see more and more of this, and, when it starts to have real impact on the way that, nations behave themselves when they're arguing with each other, it's going to be interesting times, man.
Well, I mean, no one from the French government has put their name to this. This is according to an article that ran in the newspaper Le Express. Which, I don't know, is there a more pretentious way I could say, what is it? What's that old saying? Pretentious, moi? So there you go. Anyway, French getting owned by Le Flame.
Indeed.
Now, speaking of ownage, FreeBSD has been owned, and the, FreeBSD boxes that deal with, like, incorporating third-party packages have been owned completely up the wazoo. So if you're running recent BSD with third-party packages, you could be pretty owned pretty hard.
Yeah, I guess this is one of, many ownages we've seen of software build and packaging systems in, in open source Unix projects. Obviously, Debian, Red Hat, and of course now FreeBSD. This is a pretty bad thing. So obviously, there's, enough problems as it is with the security of our software supply chain. And seeing things like this happen, whilst not, I guess, entirely unexpected, isn't good for the credibility of our software sources. And yeah, I mean, the FreeBSD guys have been through and apparently audited the boxes that had that were owned, but once you get a compromise like this, like, getting them out is really, really difficult.
It is, and trying to figure out which packages they've messed with, I suppose. I mean, it's doable, but it's a pain in the ass. God.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in some cases, like, the fact being that they're an open source project has some advantages in that you have a lot of public records of check-ins, and you can attribute code changes to a certain extent and try and compare them with what's in the repositories. But, doing that process on a large scale and automated fashion is not something we've really done yet in the open source community. And it's certainly, a useful avenue for, PhD researchers. Hi there. If you'd like to do that. But it really doesn't make me feel good.
Now, Andrew Ornheimer, better known as Weave, has been found guilty over the AT&T iPad thing. This is when he used, like, a direct object reference bug to automate some scraping of an AT&T site and grabbing, harvesting user details. There were IRC logs tended to evidence where they were talking about forming a goatsy security company so that they could somehow monetize, this bug, and he looks like he's in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I mean, it's good in some respects, I suppose. Because, I mean, you know, of all the stupid things that Weave's done, you know, I guess he probably does deserve to get into some trouble for some of them. But yeah, like getting 10 years for web scraping, you know, Apple's user data, you know, seems a little bit kind of,
Harsh.
it does seem a bit harsh. I mean, that's the maximum, I guess, that he hasn't actually been sentenced. And of course, he's going to appeal the current thing. But yeah, it's I guess this is one we'll definitely keep an eye on because it, you know, it does set a precedent. Because, you know, it wasn't a particularly serious business hack, and they talked about monetizing, but they didn't actually do it.
Well, I think that's what really got him in the most trouble. It wasn't so much that they actually scraped this site. I mean, they harvested something like 120,000 accounts, you know, and they actually released some of the data, but they said they did it with the intention of warning AT&T. And then, you know, there was like a lot of ha 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 in IRC, maybe we can make money out of this. And I don't know, they just didn't. I think if they had have just done a bit of a proof of concept like our buddy Pat Webster did here in Australia, I mean, admittedly, he, you know, grabbed about 600 PDFs while he was making a cup of tea, but then he stopped the script and let them know. Do you know what I mean? They still tried to sue him. They still called the police, but the police just said, huh? Weren't interested. I mean, I imagine if he had done something similar, it would have worked out a bit better for him.
Yeah, I guess it does suggest that there is a reasonable line of education, you know, a good contour somewhere to talk about exactly how you should go about making yourself not look like a dick when you're finding these things, you know, when you're messing with public systems and you don't want to end up going to pound you in the ass.
I think Weave could use like maybe 4 years of remedial training into how not be a dick.
Yeah, exactly. Like that guy definitely does need the how to not be a dick lessons.
Yes. I don't know. Some people, you just can't learn them. Anyway, now we've covered this massive data breach in South Carolina, the U.S. state of South Carolina. Where you know, they got basically data on everyone who lives there, including all their social security numbers and stuff. Not surprisingly, a story has emerged on ThreatPost that says that the people who obtained this data had access in there for months. So rattling around in there for months. No big surprise here.
No, certainly not a surprise at all. And I think you know, that's not the surprising bit. What is nice to see, I guess, is that you know, there's been some discussion about the fact that this department was compliant with all the relevant requirements from the American IRS in terms of how they handle data and their procedures and things. And it's kind of nice to see people saying, well, yes, just because we were compliant doesn't mean we actually did enough, you know, to prevent this. And that's a good thing for a lot of people to hear.
Well, it's kind of like that scene in Office Space, right? You know, how many pieces of flair are you wearing?
Well,
what do we think of
we
someone
think.
Who just does the bare minimum? The bare minimum. So there you go. Now, I think there's still some lawsuits going ahead in this. I mean, I think the security provider, I can't remember who it was.
It was Trustwave, wasn't it?
Trustwave, yeah, it was Trustwave. I think they're going to get sued and... you know, there's going to be a lot of fallout from this. We're talking about millions of records and some pretty sensitive data. So we'll just keep following it for the next few weeks, and then we will pick it up again next year. Now, look, I really dig this next story. Very simple story, really. A group of researchers has basically written a USB to TCP driver so that you can very easily man-in-the-middle stuff like USB smart cards. Simple idea, good one.
Yeah, it is. It's exactly. It's one of those things that, you know, once you see it, you think, well, of course, that's a really, you know, obvious thing to want to do. But until someone does it, yeah, you don't really realize. But yeah, this is shunts USB data around across the network, and you can use it to, in their example, man in the middle smart cards across the internet, or remotely use a smart card on a system that you've owned. And that, you know, I guess having a practical working implementation of that does change you know, a bit of the way people will think about the risk of smart cards or the exposure of smart card stored credentials to client-side compromises. And that's, you know, that's a useful discussion to have.
Well, the Mandiant guys put out a paper, I think it was last year or the year before, which just showed how this sort of man-in-the-middling could be done. But it looks like this is going to be a public tool and, you know, everyone can use it.
Yeah, exactly. And the malware.lu guys are fairly smart, and I'm sure it will work well.
Yeah, I don't know if they're releasing it. Does it say here?
No, I'm not sure. They're going to talk about it at, I believe, what, Malcon in India later this week. So we'll see what they drop.
Yeah, but it won't work again. Those smart cards with the built-in displays, like they've got like a one-time pass LCD on them that we always laugh at them and go, oh, they're dumb. But they'd kind of get around this.
Yeah, and even ones that have like a single press button, like was it the YubiKey devices where you have to assert that you want it to do whatever it's being asked to do by pressing it, and that, you know, does mean that if you're going to get someone to, if you want to steal someone's data, then you have to social engineer them into believing they're doing a legitimate transaction as well, which obviously you know, removes some of the automatedness of the attacks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll get there eventually with 2FA. At least we're starting to build some of the basic infrastructure, you know, and put card readers everywhere. And anyway, so we'll see how that goes. Oh, now, in breaking news, turns out John McAfee is completely f***ing nuts.
Yeah, you're going to have to do the bit right in there to announce that particular piece of shocking breaking news. Yeah. John McAfee is, according to a new ebook apparently that Wired are putting out, unhinged. Who knew?
Yeah, well, what's interesting about this, I mean, it's brilliant timing really because for Joshua Davis of Wired, because what he did is when this news broke about his first, you know, John McAfee's first raid, you know, with the gang suppression unit and stuff in Belize, you know, he got his ass down there and decided that this would be, you know, that this guy would make a really interesting subject for a book. So they've actually brought forward the release of the book given, you know, recent events. But man, the more you read about John McAfee's life in Belize, I mean, he was living with like five women and, you know, like has all these bodyguards and guns and he's quite paranoid. And I mean, no one really knows if he killed his neighbor. I mean, he's wanted for questioning, but there's even been a suggestion floated that he may have just been mouthing off about how he didn't like the guy and maybe one of his goons thought they'd do him a favor. So we really just don't know what's happened down there. But what is becoming increasingly clear is that he's certainly a very unconventional man.
Yeah, there was some reports that he had seen, what, like 40 police officers that magically disappeared later on that morning, you know, seeing imaginary pigs coming after him in his hotel room and, you know, pretending to be, you know, obnoxious German tourists or hawkers on the beach flogging off, you know, Belizean artifacts to reporters who are reporting on the fact that he's missing. He definitely does sound like there's a, you know, a few jams sort of his picnic right there.
Now, a funny side note, too, is that he is actually running a blog while he's on the run, which is called Who is McAfee? .com. But yeah, what a saga, you know. I mean, it's just, you don't know what to think about this because it seems like, yeah, he's probably, you know, him and reality aren't too tight anymore. You know?
Yeah. Although I did like Kevin Mitnick tweeted at him saying, you know, here's my top tips for being on the lam. So that's nice to see. You know, Kevin's nice. Consultancy business is going very well.
That's it. There you go. Oh, now here's a fun one. Microsoft screwed up its download page for Windows 8 Pro. So you could actually just trick it into giving you a license. Yay.
Yeah, apparently you could download Windows Media Center, which was free or is free at the moment, and then upgrade that to Windows 8 Pro, and in the process obtain a Windows 8 Pro license, you know, kind of unlimited without any particular restrictions, which means, of course, yeah, free Windows 8 licenses for everybody. Very nice.
There you go. We'll have to see if they can deal with that with some sort of revocation. You'd think they'd be able to fix it.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, if you were getting the license, you know, through a legitimate channel, you know, even if it is accidental, I guess it would be kind of a dick move for them to turn around and go, no, now you can't anymore. No.
Now, in its grand tradition of doing just this, Anonymous is sticking its nose into affairs that it doesn't fully understand or comprehend. It's escalating its cyber war against Israel.
Yeah, and good luck with that, guys, because, yeah, you know, maybe you want to pick off something you can actually chew on there. I'm sure the Israelis are going to give you a run for your money, and it does seem that you know, the denial-of-service attacks we've seen have been largely, you know, successfully repulsed by the Israeli Cyber Defense Force or whoever is down there blackholing those packets.
Yeah, it's funny, though, because, like, I just think it's funny how everyone, you know, we've seen Anonymous do this in Syria as well. They sort of cling to the simple narrative, which is it's a government versus the people, when it's not. It's about five or six different religious and ethnic groups, one of whom, which happens to be in power at the moment, but it's like these five or six different groups all in it for themselves, all claiming the others are dogs and murderers. Do you know what I mean? So they're trying to boil it down in this case to Israel is you know, persecuting Palestinians, or, you know, on the other side, people are saying, well, Hamas are terrorists. And I think I said it before on the show, but Middle Eastern politics is a four-dimensional object in a seven-dimensional space. Good luck figuring it out.
Well, exactly. Yeah, it is. It is a very, very complicated space. And, you know, yeah, finding anyone who can coherently explain their position, I guess, is unusual in this debate. But
yeah.
You know, we're seeing it escalate. We saw there was a brief period yesterday, I think, when the Facebook page of like the Israeli vice president was defaced with a Free Palestine message, although that got cleared up pretty quick by the look of things. So yeah, I'm sure we'll see that kind of those kind of skirmishes. But really, you know, you have to question whether or not this kind of stuff is, you know, in the context of people being blown up and, you know, actual real wars of the kind that, you know, is clearly in the process of breaking out. Whether, you know, defacing someone's Facebook page really does make much of a difference.
I'm not pro-Israel and I'm not pro-Hamas. I'm just anti-dick. And yeah, the thing is, there's dicks on both sides. And as long as these dicks keep being dickish, then it's going to continue. So I don't know. I just think it's funny that people who claim to be proponents of peace pick sides. And it's like, that's kind of not the point, is it?
Yeah, and certainly in an environment like this where it, you know, it is much more complicated than the simple narrative, as you said.
Anyway, yeah, well, moving on. And Obama has apparently signed in. We missed this one last week. He's apparently signed a secretive cybersecurity policy directive, which looks like it's along the lines of that, you know, executive order. But it enables them to actually engage in a bit of offense when it's for defense. So, you know, they're being attacked by a box. They might be able to have a poke back at it and stuff like that. But, I mean, this is because they haven't been able to get their legislation through Congress. So they've kind of done it as an executive order.
Yeah, it's a bit of a runaround, I guess, against the partisan issues we've seen with them trying to pass actual proper law. And it's not entirely clear, I guess, it being a secretive presidential policy directive, exactly what it means. The assertion is that, yeah, that they are authorized in some circumstances to conduct, you know, offensive operations in the sense of owning other people back in a defensive circumstance, which is, you know, I guess there are plenty of cases where, you know, for tracking down attribution or whatever, that owning someone's CNC or whatever is a thing that you need to do.
Yeah, but this is the country that invaded Iraq in self-defense, huh?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I was going to get to that. Yes, yeah. It's, yeah, it's very unclear, certainly from this side of the fence, exactly what this means. I guess we won't know either for a long time until, you know, they actually pass some laws that make it clear exactly what's going on. But I'm sure all the, you know, the shadowy jerks in the mill industrial cyberland in the US are, you know, quite happily polishing their cyber tools or whatever.
Yes, of course. I love that Bill Maher quote from a few years ago, which is, ladies and gentlemen, on the 11th of September 2001, our nation was attacked by a group of Saudi Arabians operating out of Germany and Pakistan. And by that I mean, we were attacked by Iraq. Now, look, I don't want to even dwell on this one at all, but just an interesting news factoid, which is that Facebook is enabling HTTPS by default for North American users, which is a positive thing, TM.
Yeah, I mean, they've been talking about it for a while, and they are actually now putting it live in, I guess, what is probably their biggest market. So, that's, yeah, it's a good thing for everybody.
Oh, now, here's an interesting one. Here in Australia, NICTA, which is like a sort of government, you know, private, you know, research and development body. They've been supporting a company here that makes like mathematically proven kernels, like it's the SEL4 operating system. And we actually had the guy on the show talking about this, like might have even been a couple of years ago. But DARPA has just shoveled a ton of money at them to get this stuff working on their drones. So yeah, Australian research and development, yay killer robots.
Yeah, there was, what, like $17 million Aussie dollars worth of funding, which, you know, that's a pretty good catch. And I'm sure the guys who are, you know, been working on this are very pleased to see someone taking up their research. You know, I'm always a little bit dubious of these kind of academic, you know, provably secure systems because I'm making them work in a real environment. You know, usually involves some kind of, you know, sneaky watering down exactly what they're trying to achieve. But, you know, obviously, you know, in a drone system, you probably do want to, you know, make the effort at least. So it's good to see that they are doing that.
Oh, now a bit of news from KiwiCon. And Darren Pawley, our buddy from SC Magazine in Australia, he flew over. G'day, Daz, if you're listening. And he wrote up a couple of the talks. One was by an Australian guy named Peter Hannay from Out West. Hi, Peter. Who did a talk about owning Androids and iPhones with Exchange. And it's an awesome way that it's done, which is that you don't actually directly attack the phone. Because there's all these like policy constraints when you're using Exchange on these devices. It said you must do this, you must do that. But what you can do is you can actually really easily man in the middle of policy settings and like remote wipe the devices because, anyway, you explain it.
Yeah, it's quite a cool talk. It's Peter did it at, I think, DEF CON earlier this year and then again at KiwiCon. And it was, yeah, basically discussing using the Microsoft ActiveSync protocol to, you know, apply policies to people's devices. And then this is meant to be done over SSL. And some of the devices that are, you know, some of the non-Microsoft devices aren't quite so rigorous about their certificate checking. So you can, you know, kind of push out a policy that says, you know, I would like you to have a password that's 65,000 characters long and you get one try. Terribly sorry.
Yeah.
Or, as you say, yeah, remotely wipe the phone, which is not exactly what you're looking for in a fleet of corporate phones.
No, but I mean, that's just, yeah, pretty funny ownage, that one is. Oh, now, our buddy Cartel did a talk about owning managed service platforms, and some of the bugs were just hilarious. Like, there was one where you put a registry key into, you download the client, you install it, and then you put in this, like, really sort of malformed, long registry key, which then gets sucked into the database of the managed service platform, and then bang, you've got an admin account.
Yeah,
because it doesn't sanitize its data in its own database.
Yeah, there's some, definitely some pretty nasty bugs. I mean, building any kind of large distributed system is difficult, and having one that is necessarily privileged by virtue of being a management platform, you know, certainly escalates the risk from any bug. And like, you know, any piece of software, there are things that are horribly, horribly wrong. And the cartel dropped a number of fairly nasty bugs in some of the managed service provider platforms, which they are scrambling to fix by the look of things.
Yeah, but I mean, these are bugs that are so boneheaded that it just makes you wonder what else is there, you know?
Well, I mean, of course, right? I mean, these pieces of software most likely have never been reviewed, never been, you know, examined by anyone who understands security. And that's typical of like any, you know, somewhat niche, large software system, right? I mean, we see it in any of the small areas where you see this kind of complicated software. It's just, unfortunately, it's sadly normal. And security vendors are, you know, well, management vendors are, you know, amongst the worst, you know.
Now, we're seeing a bit of a trend emerge in the American judiciary. A judge has just thrown out a consumer lawsuit against Steam over its breach. And they're saying, well, look, you can't really prove that you've been harmed. Beyond your data being exposed, you can't really demonstrate that there's been tangible harm. So they've tossed the lawsuit. Now, we've seen a few go that way. Sony was another one. I think there is a lawsuit against Blizzard, but I'd expect that to go the same way. It seems like the courts have sort of made up their mind in the US that these sort of actions should just be dismissed.
Yeah, and, you know, on one hand, I guess it's nice to see some sanity and some actual argument about real, actual damages coming up. Because, you know, historically, we have seen lots of cases where hackers have been prosecuted for causing billions of dollars worth of damage when there's no direct link to that actual harm. And so seeing this argument on the other side, I think, is a good thing. You know, it'll help with more sensible prosecutions elsewhere. But on the other hand, you know, you can only lose your privacy once, you know? And if you've lost, for example, your password reset questions, you know, like your mother's maiden name, your date of birth, right? Those are credential items that you just can't change. And so it's a bit disingenuous, perhaps, to say that you can't prove damage there, I mean, or that you can't prove the harm there because, you know, that information can't be unlost.
Yeah, I think they're talking. I mean, I think it's a difference between harm and tangible harm. And that's where it gets interesting. And the courts have just said, look, we're not going to define this as being a tangible, you know, harm to, of tangible harm to you.
Yeah, and I, you know, I'm not sure how much I agree with that, but you know, we will see. You know, I guess when there is when there are some breaches that really do have very tangible harm, how that goes.
Well, I mean, we have seen them, and we have seen lawsuits arriving from them, but that's usually in a business-to-business context. So it's interesting to see this sort of precedent being set in consumer lawsuits. But look, that's all we're going to have time for, Adam. Lovely to chat to you, mate. It was good to see you over the weekend down at KiwiCon, and we'll catch you again next week.
Cheers, Pat. I'm kind of glad that the con is behind, and yeah, looking forward to the last couple of shows of the year.
That was Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines. Before I continue, I just want to say a big thanks to our hosting provider, Virtual Office, that's OFFIS, for their stellar work over the last few years keeping us running. Great service. So if you need some serious business hosting in Australia, these guys really have a good setup. So to Chai and the gang, cheers, big ears. Thanks a lot for all your help. Okay, it's on to this week's feature audio now, which is a recording of part of a panel session from KiwiCon last week. So I recorded John Callis, Peter Gutman, and Nico van Someren chatting about a few topics. And here are their bios from the KiwiCon website. John Callis is a co-founder of PGP Corporation and Silent Circle. He is a co-author of the Skein finalist for SHA-3 and has worked on everything from operating systems to user experience on everything from PDP-11s to iPhones, and you'll hear him. He's the one with the American accent. Peter Gutman is a professional paranoid at the Department of Computer Science at the University of Auckland and quite well known to Risky Business listeners. He's a frequent guest. He was on the show just a few weeks ago. And Peter, obviously, is the one with the Kiwi accent. And finally, Nico van Someren is co-founder of nCipher, one of the major developers of secure hardware before it was bought by Thales. He is a fellow of both the Royal Academy of Engineering and the British Computer Society, and not surprisingly, he is the one who speaks with a British accent. So I'll drop you in here where an audience member asks John Callis if cloud computing, stuff like Amazon EC2 processing on demand, represents a threat to contemporary encryption.
So the question was, you know, people applying large amounts of money at cracking crypto. And in many cases, The answer is move up to a larger key size, and that's relatively easy to do. That today, we've all been told, you know, NIST U.S. NIST comes up with nice little guidelines on it, and they said everybody's supposed to be off 1024-bit RSA keys by the end of 2010, knowing full well that that wasn't going to happen, but they had to put a date. This is the same thing that I'm talking about. You pick a date. And then they said, well, okay, we really mean it by the end of 2013. So then they've said, well, you should be moving to 2048. And if you go to a website called keylength.com, which was put together by Arjen Lenstra, who's a number theorist and cryptography and a bunch of his students, you can put in parameters where there are models for how good a key is that start with assumptions like assume that the attacker cannot violate the laws of physics. That, you know, the speed of light is only so fast that they don't have secret alien technology or telepathy that can read the password out of your brain, and then they come up with how good things are for those. To give a sort of the punchline away, assuming that Moore's law continues indefinitely, 128-bit crypto, which would be like AES 128, 3,000-bit RSA keys or 256-bit elliptic curve keys, those should be good until around 2050, 2060. And 256-bit crypto ought to be good for another 100 years after that, which is a good estimate. And, you know, I've often said about some things where people want to over-design it, where we have to leave some things for our grandchildren, otherwise they'll just get lazy and play video games all day.
So I'm going to provide a completely different angle on this. In terms of crypto attacks, Bruce Schneier has said crypto is always bypassed, never attacked. So no one's going to get you by attacking your private, trying to factor your public key or whatever. They're going to get you via a SQL injection vulnerability in a PHP script on a machine you never even knew existed. It's not worth attacking crypto because there are thousands or I don't know how many of, you know, vulnerabilities that are far easier than that. So it's no point in making your crypto super secure if everything else is just paper mache.
If I had the budget of an intelligence agency, I would invest in 0 days, not in supercomputers.
Exactly.
But I would take issue with what you just said, because, you know, we can look back in the last couple of years and there have been notable attacks on, for instance, you know, first the TI pocket calculator code signing
with
the toy key, but if people hadn't bothered to look at the crypto of the PS3, we never would have found that everything's signed with the same random number and we can get the private key out. And that was a crypto implementation, a usage failure rather than a crypto failure per se, but it's still attack on the crypto side of it. And I think that, you know, we need to understand that we do have to do our crypto right, and we do have to do our crypto with appropriate length keys. You know,
no matter what the key length would have
but
been.
But we can look at the SSL observatory data from, you know, EFF, and we can find tens or hundreds of thousands of websites that are still using 512-bit RSA keys, and even more who are still using 768-bit RSA keys. And you can just go and look them up.
But is that a weakness if your website is serving up knitting recipes?
It depends on what your threat model is. You know, if these are secret knitting recipes, you might have, you know, this might...
There's a use case on these things. If you changed your RSA key every week or day, and you did everything else correctly, a 768-bit key would be good enough, and very likely even, well, maybe not for a week, but every day, a 512-bit key would be good enough, because it still takes... Well, okay, a supercomputer could do it in a day.
Take for example, there's a print server that I have sitting in a cupboard somewhere which uses a 512-bit key. And yes, technically that can be factored. Which means that if an attacker who is in my internal firewalled LAN can then attack this thing, so they already have to be on my LAN and have control of that, they can attack this thing and they can then get to my printer and turn off toner saving. It's not a credible threat.
I carry a wireless router in my luggage, to get plugged into the hotel networks, and the password on my wireless network is in fact one of the top 10 most widely used passwords. You know, and because it's a no trespassing sign, I don't care if somebody uses my hotel wireless. I actually really don't. You know, Bruce Schneier keeps open wireless at his home, and people ask him about it, and he says, "Well, I want to be neighborly. What if one of my neighbors wants to use it?"
So yeah, it's a case of balancing the threat with the defense. And in a lot of cases, if you're looking at the numbers, it doesn't matter if you've got a 1,000-bit key or 2,000-bit key, because you're not that interesting to attackers, and or there's much easier ways of attacking you than going after your key.
Yep. Yep. Well, I'm glad you asked that, because I was actually wondering that. I mean, it's like, from a threat point of view, would it matter if you just switch it off?
Well, these servers are occasionally used on sites that print classified documents, and they have some requirement to use some sort of encryption.
Okay.
It's basically a checkbox requirement.
Okay. There's a gentleman with a black glove up there.
Oh, hi. At this point, a delegate asks the panel what they think of quantum computing. You couldn't really hear it, so that's why I'm back, but I'll drop you back in. Enjoy.
I'm glad you asked that.
Who wants to take it?
I'll take it.
We both have opinions.
Yeah. I'm skeptical of that quantum computers will arrive before the mythical, let's assume that Moore's Law continues indefinitely. So far, they've been able with a quantum computer to factor 15 twice, and 15 is important number. Pardon?
21.
They're up to 21. Wow.
So,
cool.
So in
21.
10 years, they've made a huge leap.
Yeah, from 15 to 21.
They've made a quantum leap.
Yeah,
so,
they made a quantum leap.
So, you know, and these are both numbers that are 2 to the n plus 1 and 2 to the n minus 1, which are important because 2 to the n plus 1 is a 1, a bunch of zeros, and a 1, and 2 to the n minus 1 is just a bunch of 1s. And those are special form numbers that are easier to factor than anything else. When we saw the transistor first arrive, within a year or so, it got put into a hearing aid. And then it got put into transistor radios. And then you got 2D2 transistor radios. And then eventually we got to the point where, you know, your LCD screen has 3 transistors per pixel. And that was the Moore's Law effect. We haven't seen anything around that indicates that quantum computers are going to arrive anytime soon. Also, Shor's algorithm is for integers anyway, for RSA and integer Diffie-Hellman, 72k cubed, and cubed might be too big a polynomial. You know, if it turns out that p equals np and there's a polynomial way to factor, if that's x to the 100th, it won't matter. It may not matter if it's even to the third.
You may want to add subtitles to some of this, like Shor's algorithm and so on.
Okay, Shor's algorithm is a quantum algorithm that can factor or do discrete logs in polynomial time, and it is cubed time depending upon the length of the key, the length of the key. And if you say that you don't want to do RSA keys bigger than 4K, that works out to be a few trillion of quantum operations, quote-unquote quantum gates. And that's a long way off when we're factoring 21.
Yeah. I'm in two minds about quantum crypto, and I never know which until I look, but
Oh, that's good. I love that. Yeah.
I think that... as John says, the progress on this has not been anywhere near as fast as all of the people who've promoted quantum crypto have suggested it ought to be. And we are going to need radical improvements both in the implementations of quantum computing and also in the algorithms that we make use of that quantum computing for, in order to build quantum computers that can do anything very useful. The sci-fi reading part of me still thinks that it's a great idea, and I'm very happy for people to continue to pour time and money and energy into trying to improve quantum computing, because the idea that I can build a circuit of gates and put the answer in the output and get the question out the front just is so appealing that I'm very happy for people to continue. But I think we're a very, very long way from having anything useful with it. And I think that we're going to see all sorts of other changes in the way that computing is being built. You know, the advances that we're getting from regular Moore's Law are just so, you know, overwhelming. You know, we're rapidly reaching the point where we can't actually use all the computing power we've got anyway. You know, a higher def version of Angry Birds does not count as a real... You know. It's like, great, you can buy for $100 a phone which has 4 1.5 gigahertz processors in it and 1 gigabyte of RAM and many gigabytes of storage. You know, the latest iPad has more processing power, more storage, and more RAM than the biggest IBM 370 mainframe that IBM ever built. And I was telling this to an audience last week at another conference, and I asked, so who here has deployed systems on IBM 370s? And about 3/4 of the room, they were bankers mostly, put their hands up. And I said, who still runs systems on IBM 370s? And only about half of them put their hands down. And it's like, you know, there's 40% of this room could be running their entire banking systems on an iPad. You know, we have more compute power than we know what to do with. And, you know, I suspect that this is the source of many of the problems in this industry.
Do you want to say we're beginning the...
Ooh. Oh, okay. We've overrun. So, yeah. But we're around. So,
yes.
If any other questions, come find us.
That was three guys with ponytails discussing security at KiwiCon in Wellington last week. And it was funny, I caught up with John Callis for a chat afterwards. And yeah, he's a really nice guy. But the question I had for him is how you start a small business, build it into a large business, sell it to McAfee for gazillions of dollars, buy it back in 5 cents in the dollar, and then sell it again for gazillions of dollars to Symantec, which is exactly what they did with PGP Corporation. Now that is a good trick. It's time for this week's sponsor interview now with Brad Arkin, the Director of Product Security and Privacy at Adobe. And we are very thankful to Adobe for its support of the podcast. So yeah, massive thanks to Adobe. And we're chatting to Brad about a few things this week. The fact that Flash is now sandboxed on every mainstream platform. You can actually find a browser and OS combo across all OSs that will, you know, sandbox your Flash and not get you pwned. We're also going to talk about the recent ownage that affected the company's Connect user forum. And finally, we'll be chatting about what Brad calls Phantom O-Day. So Brad, first up, looks like you guys have actually finished sandboxing the Flash plugin across pretty much all platforms. Is that all browsers and all platforms or just all platforms?
So the latest thing that happened is that the Google Chrome guys came out with a version of Chrome that has sandboxing for Flash Player for Mac OS X. And so now it's not every browser on every platform, but there is a browser platform combo that includes sandboxing across every PC that you can find. So Mac, Windows, in different flavors of browsers on Windows. So Firefox and Chrome, as well as Internet Explorer.
What about Linux?
So Linux, there's still a version of Flash Player that's supported on Linux, but from a feature perspective, it's frozen a few versions back. Mm. And so we're going to be backporting security fixes for Linux for that version. But in terms of new features, it's not going to be moving forward.
So you're not going to issue a sandboxed version?
Yeah, I don't think that's in the roadmap for that.
Yeah, I guess there would be a little bit of development cost involved in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what we're doing is anything that's you know, any vulnerability that comes to us through any channel, we check to see if it's relevant for any of the supported code bases, which includes Flash Player for Linux. And if it is, then we backport those fixes across all the branches. So the Linux guys are going to continue to get those fixes, but they won't get any new features.
So there you go. Anyway, if you're running Windows, any sort of flavor of Windows, or OS 10, you can run Flash and be fairly confident you're not going to get owned.
Yeah, sandboxing has proven really effective at raising the cost for the bad guys, and so we definitely encourage people to look for a, you know, browser platform combo that offers sandboxing.
Cool. Well, achievement unlocked. Well done.
Yeah. Now,
some less fortunate news for you guys, though, was this apparent breach of the Connect Users website. What is the Connect Users website?
So it's something that the marketing department went with a third party to develop and host this thing.
Why do all tales of epic ownage start with, well, the marketing department was thinking ...
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. You know, they've got certain criteria, and cost is one of them. And so they went out of house and got this thing put together. And basically it was a presence for forum discussion, people who wanted to ask questions about the product, and also for posting information about, like, we're going to be doing a user group live event at this location, you can sign up here, you know, that kind of stuff. And when the Pastebin leak was first posted, we saw it within a couple minutes, and we were looking at it, and it was a real head scratcher because it wasn't labeled which database it came from. And we saw a lot of valid Adobe employees there, but it was MD5 hashes, unsalted MD5 hashes, which those don't really exist inside Adobe. And so we were trying to figure out, you know, this valid looking dump, but it contained things that don't really exist inside databases that we know about. So we ended up cracking the passwords in the leak as one of the steps that we were doing to figure out where it might have come from. And then between the what the cracked passwords were, you know, had a lot of words like Connect or Breeze, which is an old brand name for Connect product. And so that gave us a tip. And then a lot of the Adobe employees that were mentioned work for the Connect product. And so we were able to track that down, but we were looking at the connected hosted services. And so if you are a Connect customer, you can have Adobe host that for you. And so we're looking at those databases, but the passwords are not stored in unsalted MD5. And so we had a hard time figuring it out until somebody's like, wait a minute, did anyone think about the connectusers.com database? And then, you know, all the support engineers are like, well, what's that? Once we tracked that down, then we're like, oh yeah, that's it. And so we took it offline, and it was about 4 hours start to finish for us to go through that goose chase. Mm. You know, the mechanics of it, it was just a SQL injection. The machine looks like it was up to date. So I think that the product itself had, just some bad use of database queries in there. But the for us, the exciting part was trying to figure out, you know, how do you track down a phantom database that doesn't really exist in our registry of known systems? And so that was the one part of that response that was a little bit different from the normal for us.
Now, did you send out a notification to all of the affected users?
Yeah, so that took us, we took the site offline and had a notice there, and we posted a blog post, within an hour after that. And then the next day we sent out a message saying, here's what happened. We're going to be doing a password reset. And so keep an eye out for that. And then we also looked at any username accounts that existed within the Connect Users database. We looked across all the other different Adobe registries, and anytime there was a duplicate of the user across different, like, user registries that we have, then we reset them there too, just to be really safe. And so those messages went out within 24 hours after the Pastebin link went up. And then we're having a little bit of a chat with the department. And so So connectusers.com isn't up, and it's unlikely to come back in its original form. So we're probably going to bring that in house.
I was going to say, like, has there been any sort of policy update in terms of, outsourcing this sort of thing?
Yeah. I don't know if it's a policy update as much as a refresher of existing policies.
Yes.
A little bit of both there. Yeah.
So someone may have got a spanking over this.
Perhaps.
Okay, right. Now, look, something else that's been dragging on for the last few weeks for you guys, you mentioned phantom databases just a bit earlier, like trying to track it down. You guys have been confronting a phantom ODA. Now, Adam Boileau and myself have discussed this in the news a couple of times. there was this company based in Russia that had said, hey, we've got a Reader 10 sandbox bypass, completely elite O-Day. It's trading on forums for $50K a pop, which, you know, if you've stated on the show many times that it's been your objective to raise the cost of exploitation. And, you know, given that an Adobe Reader O-Day a few years ago was probably worth about $100, I think even the idea that they could be sold for $50,000 is a bit of a win for you guys. But it got weird because the demonstration video they had, the process name in it wasn't a default process name, and now they've failed to cough up a sample. And I mean, there's no way for you guys to know if this is actually a real threat.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, we'll frequently hear about, I guess you could label it a rumor. You know, so we look at Twitter, social media, everything else. And so when these things come across, we always try to reach out, and we've gotten over the years a lot of relationships. And so we can usually get in touch with somebody who knows somebody. And GroupIB is a firm that we did not have a connection to directly. And they announced the news in an unusual way with a press release, which is, you know, sort of different than the usual. And so we got in touch with their US PR contact, which is the only person that we were able to track down. And he said, yeah, it's the thing that we shared with you guys. And we said, oh, no, we didn't receive anything. So we, you know, tracked down every single spam filter and, you know, where could this possibly have gotten lost? And, you know, yelling at people about dropping things on the floor. And it turns out that nothing was sent in advance. And then that was chalked up to some translation confusion. And so we said, well, hey, you know, we're really curious to see the sample. We'd love to fix it and protect our customers. And we've been having a lot of interactions on the phone and over email. And then there's been some interested third parties who speak Russian who have also interceded on our behalf to try to help facilitate communication. And we really appreciate all the efforts that everyone's helped us here with. But the bottom line is that today we have not seen a sample. So there's no PDF in our possession that replicates the behavior that we saw in those videos that they posted to YouTube. And apart from GroupIB employees, we haven't talked with anyone who's seen a sample. And we have heard a lot of speculation about sort of what's really going on. But from our perspective, you know, the information in the videos isn't enough to replicate anything. And we can't even figure out really a scenario that would explain what we're seeing there.
It must be frustrating as hell, though, because all you can do is just sort of sit back and keep copying a shellacking in the press, right?
Yeah, and it's, you know, we've got a PR team that tracks, you know, all the media coverage and things like this. And this generates just about the same amount of coverage as a real zero day. And in the past year, I think the only real zero days have been in Flash Player. And so in terms of press volume and tone and everything, it's bad. And it's actually worse because at least when it's a zero day, we can say like Adobe released a patch or there's a schedule or, you know.
And this one, you have to actually go to the press and go, well, we can't verify it, so we're not doing anything about it because there's nothing we can do.
Yeah. And we, in situations like this, we always want to treat it as credible because, you know, it's not obviously fabricated. There's nothing there that we can point to and say like that absolutely can't happen. And so we just have to treat it as like an open possibility and trying to hope we can get a hands-on sample.
Yeah, because if you call bullshit on it and a sample turns up, you're in all sorts of trouble, right?
Yeah. So we don't want to do that. So, but basically, I guess the good news is that through relationships like the MAP partnerships that we have, if anybody anywhere were actually being attacked by this, particularly if it was in any kind of crime pack or, you know, exploit kit, then samples would have made it to the AV community and then somebody would ship it our way. And so I think, you know, if it's real, then it's likely more of a lab sample right now that somebody has come up with but isn't using. Because if it was being used, then someone somewhere would have a copy by now. Or it may not be real, or it might be real but deeply constrained, you know, so maybe it only works in a weird scenario or something. And so rather than release it and have the, you know, the full details come out, as it's not that exciting, it might be better to keep the mystery going. So we don't really know. It's really frustrating. And also the media generates customer inquiries and, you know, everyone's nervous and they want to hear what we're doing. And we just say, well,
this would be the first one in the wild with a sandbox bypass. Well, this would be the first one. I mean, you guys haven't patched any sandbox bypasses yet, have you?
So we had the IBM researchers at a Black Hat talk in last year. They came up with a a legitimate sandbox bypass. It required a lot of social engineering, but it was, I'll give it to them, it was a real sandbox bypass. And they submitted that research to us, and we fixed it in coordination with their talk.
This would be the first like in the wild sandbox bypass.
Oh yeah, it's a big deal. Like we're really energized on this topic, but there's, after the first few days, you can only watch that video so many times, and we stopped learning from it after the third day or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I've just got this Hollywood scenario in my mind where you guys are trying to isolate background noises.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's three different, edits of the video. And so we've been watching each of those, trying to, track down a minute. We've, it's Adobe. So we got all this fancy video editing software. So, at this exact timestamp, do you see that switch and can you make out what that font is? And
it sounds like the problem is you really want to call bullshit on this, but you can't.
Oh yeah. I mean, so we want to keep our customers safe, and keeping them safe also helps giving them really clear information. And so if there's a problem, we want to understand it, fix it, tell people what they can do to protect themselves and, apply the patch or whatever. And if there's not a problem, we want to clearly communicate that, in this particular instance, we've obtained the alleged sample or whatever, and then these are the results of our investigation. We'd love to be able to get clarity on it, because there's a lot of uncertainty. Mm. And that's really frustrating for, the admins and for our customers and all that. So that's, and for me, the best outcome would be if we could say, oh, it was all a big misunderstanding. That would be awesome.
Yeah. Now, the funny thing is you can't say it's bullshit and then be wrong, but I can, Brad. So you know what I'm going to do for you right now?
I'm listening.
I'm calling bullshit. It's bullshit. Put up or shut up, guys. Come on. Don't just go for the headlines and then, this mysterious O'Days that apparently was being sold in crime forums. Apparently no one is using it. So, I got to say, my gut says it's bullshit. Or it's very constrained, as you said. It's got to be running on, WinXP with, something disabled and all of these awful other bits of software, and it's probably a bug chaining sort of horrible mess. That's just what my gut says.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll get resolution. I'd love to get a sample so we could talk about it in more detail, but yeah, the status is that we've had lots of chit chat, no show.
All right. PCAPs or it didn't happen.
Exactly.
All right, my friend, that is all we're going to have time for. And this is the last chance for us to chat this year. Because we're about to break for the summer in a few weeks. It's been great to have all of your contributions over the year, and I'm pleased to say that you guys have signed up for 6 more episodes next year, so we'll get to keep in touch.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
All right, well, again, really interesting stuff, and we'll chat to you again next year.
All right, sounds good, Patrick.
Brad Arkin of Adobe there with this week's sponsor interview, and big thanks to Adobe for its support throughout 2012, and indeed, as you just heard, into 2013. And that's it for this week's show. This week's track is an old Kiwi tune. I thought we'd go with the Kiwi theme after KiwiCon. The band is called Super Groove. This single was released back in 1994. I know I'm showing my age now. It's called Can't Get Enough, and it was a pretty big hit on both sides of the ditch. But if you want to buy it, you can, but only on the iTunes store in New Zealand, which is kind of a bummer. But great tune. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. For better, for worse, for what? When the first kids upon here, mixing up a storm, brewing up a tornado. Having an abundance of platonic relationships, reminiscent of my man, Mike Plato. I was running down the street, just screaming, I was blind, but I lost my voice like I lost my mind. And I couldn't get another, couldn't get another, couldn't get another, couldn't get another, couldn't get another.